What your physics professor never told you was that bodies in motion really do need a soundtrack. We talk with Ben Modell about the art of the chase on this episode of Mighty Movie Podcast, brought to you by Samsung. Welcome to the special music-enhanced episode of Mighty Movie Podcast, a first for us. So many frontiers still to explore. In any case, I've been wanting to talk with Ben Modell for the longest time. He's a composer, a pianist, and pertinent to our discussion here, a silent film accompanist. Places like the Museum of Modern Art, the Library of Congress, and Kino Video call upon him to fulfill that old adage that silent films were never really silent. And with Ben at the keyboard, that's all you need to fulfill a cinematic experience. Wanted him on, couldn't find the reason, and then Samsung, the sponsor for this episode, comes along with a special additional episode of their Fact Checkers Unit comedy series, one that's pretty much an extended chase sequence featuring a shape-shifting James Franco. And I think, hey, Ben's done music for Buster Keaton films, Keystone Comedies, D.W. Griffith, all that. He's got to know chase sequences inside and out. Sounds like a good guy to talk to about this. And it turns out he is. So, here's my magical musical interview with Ben, recorded at the Museum of Modern Art. Thank you, MoMA, for that. Please enjoy. Let me just get some metrics right off the bat about how many chase sequences have you composed for, just a guesstimate.
Oh, gosh, there's no way I could give you a number. I've been accompanying silent films for 30 years, so there's no way, a lot, lots and lots and lots. And it's not just composition, it's, you know, a composition in performance, you know, it's a lot of it's improvised. So, you know, if you just count, you know, just counting the comedy shorts alone, there's a huge number with at least three or four digits in it, I'm sure. But you get used to the formula and what works after a long time.
If it's Keystone, it had to have a chase in it.
Yeah, Keystone, and especially comedians like Larry Seaman, who had a lot of action in his comedies. Keystone is probably the thing everybody knows, but a lot of comedians would have these, any Senate film or even the Roach comedies that were character-driven, but there were a lot of chases in those films as well.
So let me ask you, is there ever a point where you come across a chase scene and it's just so to formula, you have to go, oh, this again, I'm just going to pull out number 22 or...
Not really. It's when they don't follow. I don't know if I would call it a formula, but a chase, whether it's from a silent film or from something made in the last 5-10 years, there's still a structure to it, and it's never 5 minutes of nonstop, quote unquote chase music. There are little elbows in it and pauses, and just like if you're driving somewhere, you hit the brakes and make a turn and speed up and slow down and stop and look around and stuff like that. And when it's when there aren't things like that, if it's poorly structured, it's a little more of a challenge. And then when you have a chase that's really well made, whether it's something that DeMille directed or Keaton, it's a lot more fun. In a sense, it's like structuring the track of a roller coaster, you know, where there are twists and turns and stops and starts. And you can tell also from listening to the audience, from their excitement of it. So when I'm playing for a film I haven't seen before, there are always surprises and stuff like that.
You know, in thinking about chase sequences, it's one of the things that I seem to feel is pure film. There's really no other medium that can replicate what a chase sequence does. So what are you looking to express in the music? How do you replicate what's coming on the screen? How do you make it audible?
Well, it's really a matter of understanding the drama that precedes it. Like you say, a chase sequence of any kind, whether it's on horseback or just some sort of a steady pursuit, is something that can't really be done on stage. And from the very beginning, from the French Pathé comedies where you had wheels of cheese chasing people through the streets of France, this was something you could not do. Unlike the rest of the film, it's a constant movement forward. It's a different kind of a mode that you're in. You have to build a sense of excitement and suspense, and you've got to pace yourself. Otherwise, you have nowhere to go after the first couple of minutes. If you're playing full-out fervent horse race music at the beginning, in the first minute or two of the chariot race of Ben-Hur, whether it's the sound or the silent version, you've got nowhere to go. It's a matter of watching the screen, and if I've had a chance to preview the film, which sometimes doesn't happen, to make mental notes of where those pauses are, where the build is, where it builds to in the climax, and there's always that moment of not an actual person hanging off a cliff, but it has the same dramatic tension as somebody about to be killed or something right before the end, and then it resolves. So you've got to follow that as well. It's tied to the drama leading up to it. And I think that that's a big part of any chase sequence, is what leads up to it, so that the stakes are sufficiently raised. It's not necessarily a chase, but Lloyd's climb up the side of the building and safety last is a kind of pursuit, maybe against gravity, but the first half of that picture sets the whole climb up. And if you watch safety last from the beginning of the climb without the buildup that explains why he goes up the side of that building, there's no tension. But if you get to see a film like that or anything with a chase, you sense this tension in the audience that's structured through editing to create a mood and suspense in the audience. So I think that's a big factor of it, is what precedes the chase. And taking, especially with silent film, it's important to take the film as seriously as the people who made it did and would want you to take it for a contemporary audience. So if the audience has gotten completely caught up with the story and are, rooting for the character, the main character who is in the chase, you've helped raise the stakes so that when the chase, starts, the excitement's already there.
So the other thing about the chase sequence is that really it can very much be, and very often is, a story in itself. So do you come into it with some idea of how to structure, and then how do you structure the music to it? Do you have a skeleton that you can call upon?
Well, I think you're right. It is a story in itself, and you can take a chase sequence out of context, and if you look at a bunch of them, there's still a similar ebb and flow to it with variations. And it's, like I said before, it's really a matter of how the stakes are built up in the reels preceding it. I guess you could say that there's a well-structured chase still has a formula. It starts at a certain pace and may gradually build to a point when then there's an obstacle that's met in some way, probably with failure, then it picks up again. And without having one in front of me, it's hard to really explain. It's always funny talking about silent movies on an audio only format. But in the same way that an entire story has a structure, a well-made chase has a structure. The trickiest ones I find are horse races. It's just for me because it's horses running at one pace around and around a track, and it's really up to the editing to sort of build in that drama while the tempo is still the same. And you've got to, at least as in terms of the music, whether it's a sound film or a silent film, you're still maintaining that, you know, it's a horse race sort of mood, while still trying to find those pauses and speed ups and that sort of thing. I don't really, you know, as you can tell, I don't really think about it so much in preparation. Mm-hmm. I'd like to say that the film is like my sheet music, so I'm watching it and I am looking all around the screen and not just at the main action to see what might be coming. So as a film accompanist, especially because the music is largely improvised, the way I work and the way a lot of my colleagues work, you're constantly anticipating what's about to happen and staying ahead of the film. So I've never had to articulate it into words as far as what the structure of a chase is. I would imagine a film editor could tell you exactly, well, this is what happens, this is what happens, this is what happens, because a lot of what I'm doing is following it and supporting it dramatically so that the audience gets excited.
Do you consider yourself in some ways an actor? Because I always feel like an actor, while they can to some extent express a theory to it and put it into words, I think there's also something instinctual about what an actor brings to it. Are you in that a similar position?
Yeah, I think so. You know, you're acting along with the film. You're going on the ride with the film. And processing the motions of the screen. I feel like I've been doing this so long that it's not even calculated anymore. The images come into my eyes and my brain, and the music comes out of my hands. And I'm not just watching the screen, but I'm trying to sense the vibe in the room as well. So at the end of a big chase sequence, you can be a little bit spent, so to speak, whether it's... there are a number of chase sequences in a film like Birth of a Nation or Horse Race in something like the Shamrock Handicap or a Keaton film, like it's Seven Chances. You're still, even though on the surface a chase is just people running and trying to catch one another, it's still an emotional ride that you go on. Like I said before, it's like a roller coaster. And it is, it does have its own self-contained structure. So absolutely, it's a mix, I think, of what you said of being rather instinctual and just sort of understanding the flow of it and just getting caught up in the emotions of it as well. So you can help express what's on screen so the audience gets inside the head of the person on screen.
I'm sure with Birth of a Nation, you're also sweating how you're going to handle the last act as well.
Well, the second half of that film makes a very bizarre left turn, very quickly.
Or right turn. As
right, well, depends. Yeah, yeah, exactly. Because the people you're rooting for are the last people, besides the Nazis, that you would want to root for in a picture. Regardless, as a silent film accompanist, your job is to you're working for the people who made the film. I'm working for Griffith or Fairbanks with, in Thief of Baghdad, let's say, or Keaton or Chaplin or Cecil B. DeMille. You're working for them, and you're trying to get their film across to the audience to the same level of excitement they would want. A contemporary audience too. So, it's really a matter of getting inside their heads as well. Because I came to doing this from also being a filmmaker. So I feel like, well, these people worked real hard and they put the stuff on screen on purpose, whether you agree with it or not, or think their technique in structuring it, let's say a chase or casting whoever it is in the chase is, like there's a chase at the end of Sally of the Sawdust. It's a D.W. Griffith film that stars W.C. Fields. And Griffith was really not a good with comedy. And so in the middle of this climactic chase, he's sticking in or allowing Fields to stick in gags where, you know, he does the bit where he loses his hat on the back of his cane, you know. And you want to say, Griffith, not now. So you're trying to structure this thing and maintain tension. In the middle of it, there's this bit of business that Fields is sort of, it's a trademark bit of business that really doesn't belong in the picture. There's a chase toward the end of Long Pants with Harry Langdon where in the middle of it, and was this Capra, was this Langdon, where there's this whole protracted bit with a fake alligator in a crate biting him, which sort of puts a damper in the whole thing. There's a gag in the middle of Cops just before the chase begins, which was missing from Prince for decades and then turned up, but it really interrupts the flow of the film. It's a sequence with the gold glance specialist, which there's a lot of debate among people if it really belongs in the picture or not, because it's in such questionable taste what this fad in the 20s actually was. So you figure, okay, well, the directors and the filmmakers put this in. I still have to make it work. So sometimes you're working with a handicap like that.
Offline, by the way, we got to talk about Cops, because that's like one of my...
I've done a score for for Keaton's Cops for orchestra and concert band, and when I scored it for Kino's their ultimate edition of the Keaton shorts, I basically replicated my orchestral and band score, but playing it on theater organs. So that might be an example for people to check out. Just seeing the structure of it, because Keaton was, and his gag writers and the people he worked with, it's really one of the great silent comedy chases. The way it's structured, and it isn't full out chasing and running around. There's these little pauses and stuff, and it's brilliantly structured, and it just rises to a feverish peak at the very end.
He was a genius.
Yeah.
Can you give us a little example of how you structure a chase story on the piano?
I don't know if I can. I'll try. But it's just a matter of you know, you'll start off not at a feverish pace. So, but you want to let people know it's a chase. Again, I don't know what's going to come out of my hands. If there's a main theme for the main character that has come up, you know, in the previous three reels, you try to weave that in, mm-hmm. or do variations on it. Some of the chase music I have for Cops is. So there are some moments where. There's a moment where the street is empty and Keaton pops up out of a garbage can, so I might have... So you can just vary it. It's something the audience may not be aware of, but it's sort of a subliminal thing. Variations on all of that, just the pauses, stopping, starting, and I'm always challenging myself to come up with new ways of doing it. And there are other kinds of, you know, chases in films where it's not, you know, people running, but more of a steady pursuit, like in Sherlock Jr. when Keaton starts trailing the guy who he thinks is committed the crime. Well, and he actually has, so you can do something. Then there's a moment where he's trailing him, and the guy's smoking a cigarette, and he pauses. Keaton pauses in split second timing, so you can do something that isn't too cartoony. Resume it, but you don't want to be too obvious. Another example that I love is in Vertigo is a sequence where Jimmy Stewart is driving his car around and around, and it's that one motif that Bernard Herrmann uses in so many films. And he keeps us up for a few minutes. I hope Kim Novak doesn't mind that I'm playing that. And it's just this simple motif over and over while he's driving around, but it's still a kind of a pursuit, you know. So there's other kinds of chases.
I haven't seen the actor yet, so I still need to understand the artist. That's it. So. I still need to understand how it equates to violent sexual assault.
Yeah.
But
well, got her name in the papers.
Yeah. Clearly you've kept up with filmmaking past the silent
era. Oh, absolutely, absolutely, sure.
But you know, once sound got into it, did you notice a change in the way the chase sequence?
Well, the first thing that you see with when sound comes in is that background music almost completely disappears. There are exceptions, but you see throughout the early to mid-30s sequences where you expect underscoring, whether it's a chase or not, and there's just no music there. I've read that there was some sort of response from both critics and the public that unless you saw where the music was coming from, you couldn't have it. There was this expectation of reality. So there are a number of films where someone will walk over and turn on a radio and then play out the scene, but the underscore is coming out of the radio. Or there'll be a scene in a nightclub, and you'll hear music, and it's kind of acting as underscore, but it's been explained to the theater audience that there's a nightclub with a band just out of camera range, so that's why you're hearing music. It's not across the board. There are certainly films from the early 30s that do have music, but there are a lot of films where there are climactic sequences where, you know, like... whether it's a boxing match or whatever, and you see not only is it done in dead silence, but it's undercranked, which is another held-over convention from silent film where it just seems odd. And at some point in the mid-30s, it starts to creep back in, just overall underscore throughout dramatic scenes, transitions from one scene to another. So it's not just chases. And then at that point, it's where it sort of picks back up and develops into what we think of as film music today. It hasn't changed drastically. It's still the same, a lot of the same rules of dramatic underscore and structure that come from opera, I think, using leitmotifs and underscoring and that sort of thing. But it's really there's this period from 1928 or 9 through the early to mid-30s where music almost drops out of the picture. There's, like I said, things like King Kong are wonderful examples of the opposite, where there is a musical score. But you see a lot of, if you get up early in the morning on TCM, often you'll see, you know, what they call pre-code films, and there's very little music where you expect musical underscore to happen.
We can thank King Kong for that, yeah. Can't we? Breaking that formula.
Yeah, I suppose it may. I don't know if it broke that tradition, but it's one of the exceptions, aside from musicals, where there's musical underscore throughout the film that holds it together, and it's a film where the score. Without the score, it would just be this piece of puppet animation. The same way that having a symphonic score for Star Wars, without whether it was John Williams or anybody, although his score is fantastic, it would just be another space movie. And so having that part of the landscape really elevated it to something else.
Weirdly enough, we've gone back. I mean, my favorite. Chase sequence from The French Connection is done completely without music. It's just sound.
Oh, absolutely. And there's a great power in an absence of music, and especially with a sound film where you have other sounds that you can use to build. And a film like the Chase from French Connection, you know, there's a lot that can be done with editing and that sort of thing. So it can absolutely work. Without music. With a silent film, you can't just stop playing the piano or the organ or have the orchestra sit out for 5 minutes. It's just not the same thing.
Cigarette break.
Yes.
For your sake, though, you absolutely have to have music.
Oh, no, absolutely. And for the audience's sake, if there's nothing... the only thing worse than seeing a silent film without music is seeing a silent film without music and run too slow. And then it's just twice as deadly. But the music, at least for silent film, it helps connect the audience with the film. There's something almost eerie or ghostly about watching a silent film without any kind of music at all. So it's whether it's me or one of my colleagues, it's an essential component. How much music you're playing is another thing. Whether it's silence or or just a sort of music you might not think of as chase music. There's a Swedish film accompanist who works with an ensemble named Matti Bie, and I saw him accompany a film. It's a film directed by Maurice Stiller called The Saga of Gösta Berling. It's one of Greta Garbo's first breakout roles, and there's a climactic scene in the middle that takes place at Nice. It's a race across ice. And he, if I'm not mistaken, uses something that's almost like a tango feel, but it's incredibly effective. You know, it builds in tempo gradually, but Garbo and her lover are chased across the ice at night by, I think it's wolves. But it's very effective. Again, it's not a chase at the end of a film where you might want something, but more exciting. But it's absolutely gripping and draws you into the drama and tension of it. I just remember his musical choices for that sequence were just brilliant.
So, a little bit about you. You've got a new project on the web, don't you?
Yeah, I've got a few things going on. The thing that I have online right now is something I decided to launch as a web series. I had been trickling these video releases on YouTube over the last year or two. Over the last number of years, I've accumulated a number of silent films in 16mm that are either rare or just lost films, as it turns out. There are maybe a few things that I have that a couple other collectors may have an old print of as well, but it's not available. And I see streaming and YouTube as the current wave of, you know, film exhibition or distribution. It's certainly more democratic, and it's gotten easier to post stuff. I have these films, and there are lots of film collectors who have the only print of something, and they're welcome to do whatever they want. I feel like I have these films, and they're just sitting on my shelf. They're not entertaining anybody. I might as well post them. So I have a couple of friends with 16mm transfer equipment. I've had the films transferred, and I've recorded scores, and I'm posting them every other week on my YouTube channel, which is Silent Film Music, all one word. And I have a number of releases already produced for video, shall we say, and ready to go for the next few months. And the first thing I released a week or so ago was a lost 1928 comedy short called Cook Papa Cook, starring a guy named Henry Murdoch. And Murdoch worked in silent comedy shorts from 1914 or 15 through 1928. But the film is actually quite funny. It was missing its main titles. A friend of mine named Steve Massa, who's a film historian and kind of an encyclopedia when it comes to silent comedy film, I got the film and I showed it to him, and he immediately identified two or three of the actors and then matched the storyline with our reviews and trade papers and said, okay, then it's this film. So now I've identified the film and it's transferred and it's available for people to see. You never know who's going to find something, not just for, oh, I'm a fan of silent movies, but there might be something that's of interest to somebody from another sphere entirely, whether it's people interested in old hats or there's a sequence in the middle of the film where the guy makes toast. And I saw something on television recently that talked about how the electric toaster was sort of a novel new thing of the early 20s. So there you see a lot of gags with toasters in silent comedies because it was this new thing that people were trying to deal with. So if you go to Silent Film Music on YouTube, you'll see this and subscribe, and there'll be a release every other Wednesday for the next number of months.
Way cool. And if people want to see you live doing your thing, where can they go?
Silentfilmmusic.com. I'm trying to... It didn't start out as branding, but I figured it seems to work. So it's silentfilmmusic.com. It has some biographical information about me, as well as a list of the scores I've done for orchestra and band, which are suitable for high school or university or professional level ensembles. They're done, a number of them are done every year. I also have my performance schedule and links to other ways to find me. I'm also on Twitter at Silent Film Music. You can follow me on Twitter and Facebook as well.
Well, if anybody's going to be directly identified with Silent Film Music, why not you?
Well, why not indeed?
Ben, thank you very much for talking with us.
Oh, it's my pleasure. Thanks so much for having me on.
So once again, you can find out more about Ben Modell at silentfilmmusic.com. And if you haven't checked out James Franco is Preggers, the latest episode of Samsung's Fact Checkers Unit, go to mightymoviepodcast.com and give the video a look, because it's weird and funny and has a number of other guest cameos, and I like it. So there. And if you want to write me, send that email to dan@mightymoviepodcast.com. And coming, hopefully, by the end of the week, an interview with Bud Clayman, the director and subject of OC87, the obsessive-compulsive major depression bipolar Asperger's movie. Lots of fascinating stuff going on in film, and we're trying to keep up with it. Thanks for listening. Have a great day. This has been a production of Upstart Company NYC, copyright 2012, Dan Persons, all rights reserved, no unauthorized duplication permitted.